The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
Money Show is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, winners of the Global Finance Magazine Best Mergers and Acquisition Bank in Africa and Best Investment Bank in Mauritius. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. We're going to talk to Captain Vernon Keller in a moment. Just how hard is it to broadside a ship the size of the Eiffel Tower in the Suez Canal, one of the busiest waterways in the world, an absolutely critical trade route? How hard is it to do what has happened in the Suez Canal in the last 24 hours? Inflation at 2.9%. Hands up if you believe it. Mine are still folded. My arms are still folded. But we'll talk about inflation. We'll talk about the blueberry industry. And I wonder where most of them are being grown. Where are blueberries being grown? Are you a blueberry farmer? I was thinking I'm trying to find something alliterative. But yes, you would have to be a farmer. And I would like to know where you grow your blueberries and whether or not you are riding the crest of the blueberry wave. Colin Cullis and Wendy Nola between 7 and half past 7. And then at after Eyewitness News at half past 7, the chair at Crystal House School. This is a Cape Town school, which is fundamentally changing the lives of kids from really, really tough backgrounds. I mean, super, hyper tough backgrounds, and showing that education is a way out for many people who are truly, truly struggling and in a really, really tough environment. So lots to come on this evening's edition of The Money Show.
The Money Show.
With Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Oh, this couldn't happen to two nicer people. Remember Victoria Gehagen? Less likely to remember Nick Lambert, but both Victoria Gehagen and Nick Lambert, the former Bell Pottinger executives, the public faces of that company's campaign for the Guptas in South Africa, the radical economic transformation campaign, the race hate campaign, the divisive campaign that ran the risk of dividing even greater divisions in South Africa. Well, they've lost an application to prevent a court case, which, if it goes ahead, could see them disqualified from being directors of UK companies for between 2 and 15 years. I'm watching that space with a great deal of interest. Well, someone's blocked the Suez Canal. A ship has done, rather than the traditional thing of keeping the pointy end facing either upstream or downstream, it's gone broadside. It's blocked the entire Suez Canal, one of the world's busiest trade routes. The ship that is stuck in the Suez Canal is longer than the Eiffel Tower is tall. It is a monster. And it means that there is no traffic going either east or west, and it could block this route, which is used to transport everything from oil to consumer goods, for several days. It's a container ship. It's run aground. Let's speak to Captain Vernon Keller. He's the Deputy Chief Operations Officer at the South Africa Maritime Safety Authority. Captain Vernon Keller, how unusual is what has happened in the Suez Canal in the last 24 hours? It doesn't see, I can't recall another grounding of this scale.
Good evening, Bruce. Thank you for having us. Yeah, I mean, it's not that easy in essence to run a vessel aground, provided that she's obviously fully functional and operational at all times. And this one, the last grounding in the Suez Canal was in 2017, where another large container ship ran aground. But likely that one was refloated in a couple of hours.
What is so different about this one? Is it the size of the ship? Is it the way in which it's so neatly wedged? I mean, you look at aerial photographs of this thing, and it's wedged itself beautifully across the entire canal.
Yeah, it's not often that you see such nice pictures. But basically what happened is a bulbous bow is basically stuck on the other side. I know that they're trying to dislodge the bulbous bow at the moment, but obviously it's very difficult under the circumstances, and they're waiting for a high tide. But this vessel, what makes it very, very difficult is that she's a fully laden, ultra-large container vessel. She's got over 20,000 containers on board, which means that if they can't refloat this vessel, it will be quite a difficult task to remove the cargo from the vessel and refloat it.
I mean, and that's, again, that then extends this mission by numerous days, no doubt. I mean, this is a very busy seaway. Just give me a picture, please, of the sort of traffic you might expect to go through the Suez Canal on an average day.
Well, Bruce, on an average day, there's about 50 ships that goes through the canal. And just to put it in perspective, about 10 to 12% of the global trade passes through the Suez Canal. So it's quite a significant amount of trade. And it ranges from everything from container vessels to general cargo to tankers. And obviously the effect on the oil market for tankers is quite astronomical.
This is absolutely critical. I mean, if this thing lasts for several days, it has a negative impact on global trade. How long does it take for a ship to go from around the Cape, for example, relative to what is the risk in terms of the Suez Canal?
Well, it can be a voyage of just more than 3,000 nautical miles in addition to what their normal voyage would be. So that could take about a week for a vessel to go around the coast, just depending on the type of vessel. Generally, a tanker, for example, moves at 16 knots, and 3,000 nautical miles adds a significant amount of time on the passage of that vessel.
But if you're sitting on either side of the Suez Canal and it doesn't look like this boat's going to be moved anytime soon, I called it a boat, sorry, ship, is going to be moved anytime soon, it may be worth your while to go the old-fashioned way around the Cape of Good Hope.
No, definitely, because if they can't refloat the vessel in the next couple of hours, then the next consideration would be to remove the cargo. And that in itself, a size of ship this way and the amount of containers that they'll have to remove has never really been done in this type of situation. So it will be quite a significant challenge. And then the vessels obviously would come around the coastline here in South Africa. And the decision to do so is quite a difficult one, because at the end of the day, you have to weigh whether you're going to wait until it clears and hopefully it clears, or whether you're going to take the plunge and actually sail around the Cape. So it's a balancing act. They'll have to decide what is the best. But more information will become clearer a little bit later, and then shipping owners can make a better decision.
It all depends, I suppose, on what your cargo is as to whether or not you can afford to wait a week or two. If it could melt or rot, you want to get your cargo to port as quickly as possible. You may be forced to make that journey. We don't get any economic benefit from a ship going around our coast, only if it calls into our harbours, I suspect.
Well, there is some sort of benefit. The more ships we see around the coast, the more bunker fuel they'll consume, and then very likely we'd have to take bunkers around the coastline. And bunkers is obviously the fuel for use for the main engines. So, and then they'll call ports and have to take supplies, most probably, depending on how well they were stocked before they left the canal. And that could add benefits to South Africa.
But it's not going to be huge, I don't think, from what you're telling us. Thank you, Captain Vernon Keller. He's Deputy Chief Operations Officer at the South Africa Maritime Safety Authority. This enormous ship, size of the Eiffel Tower, wedged beautifully and spectacularly. I mean, you couldn't have done this on purpose. Across the Suez Canal, thousands of ships could be affected, depending on how long it takes to clear the ship and get the and get it refloated. We'll know in the next couple of hours whether or not this turns into an enormous mission or into just a minor embarrassment. Former SARS Commissioner Tom Moyane's lawyers have told the State Capture Inquiry that he's suffering from a serious illness. They don't specify what that serious illness is, and they say he won't appear before the commission tomorrow. And I do hope he recovers completely. I do hope he recovers quickly, because I would like to see him proffer his version of events in the implosion of SARS capacity and capability on his watch, because I'm suffering from a serious illness too. I think everybody's suffering from a serious illness. We're sick to death. Sick of it, of the lack of accountability for the main actors in the state capture saga. I would love all of those accused to come and have the opportunity to clear their names, to show that the entire state capture narrative is inaccurate. It is wrong. They simply misunderstood. And no show without a real doctor's note should be treated as an admission of guilt. I know it's not particularly legalistic or democratic, but for goodness sake, people need to step up to the plate.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Inflation below the target range for the first time in probably years. South Africa's got an inflation target. It's set by National Treasury for the Reserve Bank. And National Treasury says to the Reserve Bank, guys, you know, we need a bit of inflation, but not too much. So could you keep inflation as best you can between 3% and 6%? And if inflation looks like it's going to remain really low, Well, then you cut interest rates and you stimulate economic activity. If it looks like it's getting a little bit hot, well, you raise interest rates and you reduce consumption in the economy and you try and balance the inflation rate between 3 and 6%. Ordinarily, an inflation rate in February of 2.9% would spell an opportunity for an interest rate cut tomorrow when the Reserve Bank's Monetary Policy Committee delivers its prognosis on the state of the economy. But we did get 3.5 percentage points last year, and nothing is ever as simple as it seems. Let's talk to Kevin Lings, StanLib Chief Economist. When last did we dip below the target band, Kevin Lings? It feels like a zillion years ago.
Evening, Bruce. That was actually last year. Slightly below, yeah. And I would say, look, it hasn't happened. You're right; it hasn't happened that often. But it did. It did move briefly below and then back up again. But I guess, you know, critically over time, inflation has been moving towards the bottom end of the target, and I guess the Reserve Bank has, to some extent, responded to that. By cutting interest rates, as you said. I think the more noticeable is that our core inflation rate, where you're stripping out things like food and petrol and energy, that's at 2.6%, and that's below the target and for the first time in a considerable length of time. So I guess if you look at the broad base of measures, inflation incredibly low in South Africa.
And the reason for that is fewer of us are consuming as much as we were a year ago.
Yeah, that's a big part of it. Obviously, with the economy being as weak as it is, it's just so difficult to pass on any sort of cost increase that companies are experiencing. It doesn't mean companies aren't experiencing cost increases. They have been, but they've struggled to pass that on. And so there's a whole range of just consumer products that the inflation rate is incredibly low. I'll give you an example, you know, clothing inflation at the moment is 0.2%. If you look at footwear, shoes, 0.6%. If you look at something like appliances, so something you would buy as a fridge or a freezer, you know, that inflation rate is well below 1%. There's a whole range of just general consumer categories where the inflation rate is incredibly low, and that in effect reflects the fact that there isn't much activity going on and that companies simply can't pass on increases, whether that increase is salaries, whether the increase is some sort of electricity cost, whatever it is. They're having to absorb a larger share of that in order to try and remain reasonably competitive and keep the consumer interested.
Now, you and I don't notice the price movements in fridges and in dishwashers and microwaves and things like that because we very seldom buy them. You might buy one every 10 years to replace an old one, whatever the case might be. So when that's included in the inflation basket, you go, oh, that's nice. But my inflation rate is much higher than the average because I like to shop at Thrupps or wherever I might like to shop. And I've got import duties and import costs to consider. My inflation rate is much higher. There's not one single soul on my Twitter account or on my facebook.com/Bruce Business page who says that their inflation rate is anywhere near 3%, never mind below 3%.
That's right, Bruce, and I'm not surprised because the inflation rate that people experience on a daily basis would certainly be higher than the average of 2.9%. And the reason is, as you say, you just don't buy a car every day, you don't buy a fridge every day. The items where inflation is especially low are, at this stage, the items you don't buy that often. But if you look at the items you do encounter, something like food, the inflation rate is 5.4%. If you look at education inflation, that's over 6%. If you look at electricity inflation, 6%. Water inflation, also around the 6%. So the items you're encountering on a monthly basis and you're much more aware of, yes, those numbers are higher. I guess what people miss is that the average of all of these categories gives you that 2.9% and therefore a fairly low number that the Reserve Bank has to be mindful of.
Talk to me about the fact that we're not likely to see an interest rate cut tomorrow, even though inflation is very well contained. Core inflation, as you said, at 2.7%. The CPI number at 2.9%. Because there are two big, scary, snotty COVID-laced boogie monsters under the bed. And one is called the fuel price and one is called the electricity price. And both of these things feed directly into future price increases.
That's right. So the inflation looks great as it stands, but the Reserve Bank will be well aware that those two factors, electricity with a 15% increase at the municipal level around the middle of the year, that's certainly going to add some pressure directly, and it may add some indirect pressure. That's one factor that has to be built in, and the Reserve Bank previously had in their estimate an electricity price increase of 8%. So they will be adjusting that to reflect the 15%. And then we've had actually quite a lot of petrol price increases in the last 4 months. They've been quite high. This month, by that I mean the start of April, we're likely to see something around the 90 to 95 cents because we've got the fuel tax that came through in the budget. It's the fuel levy and the road accident fund. So that's, I think, about 27 cents. That's got to come through next month. And then we've got a under-recovery on the normal petrol price that'll probably work out at just over 60 cents. So we're looking at another increase of 90 cents a litre. That's going to take petrol to an all-time record high. And those two factors will have a tendency to just immediately push inflation up and also create some concerns. Does it feed into other components of the inflation basket? And so the Reserve Bank will be aware that, yes, inflation's at 2.9, but literally in a couple of months' time, it could be around 5%. And you don't want to be cutting interest rates at a time when inflation is going to be obviously moving higher. So I think the Reserve Bank has been a bit cautious in the last couple of months. I expect they will remain cautious. Again, I wouldn't be surprised if it's another close vote where not all the MPC members are in full agreement. But on balance, I think they'll leave interest rates alone and highlight that there is some upside pressure in the short term. The other thing I think we've got to be mindful of is that the Reserve Bank, even though we've got this target of 3% to 6%, they really nowadays want the inflation at a target of 4.5%, not at the top end. So the idea that, yes, we slip below the bottom end of the inflation band, yes, that should give us an interest rate cut. But they don't want inflation to go back to 6%. They really are trying to get inflation expectations anchored around 4.5%. So if inflation in the next few months is moving up to 5%, it'll make the Reserve Bank a little bit uncomfortable as to where they really want this number to be anchored. So I think they'll leave it alone and argue that they've done a fair number of interest rate cuts already in the cycle.
I suspect you're right. Thank you, Kevin Lings. StanLib's chief economist, Kevin Lings, this evening on the line to us from Johannesburg. Somebody mailed me earlier this morning and said, but Brazil and Turkey are raising interest rates. The difference between Brazil and Turkey and us is they already in a much higher inflation trajectory and they're doing all kinds of scary things to try and reduce their high inflation rates. We've got a very low inflation rate, which gives us room to keep rates lower for longer for now.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Chris Stewart from 91 is our market commentator. Massively volatile day, but the most interesting thing to come out of markets today are results from Tencent, the Chinese internet business that makes an absolute fortune for Naspers and for Prosus, and its results seemed a little bit better than expected, Chris Stewart.
Yes and no, Bruce. I think maybe a bit better on the top line. The revenue number looked like it was probably 2 or 3% ahead of what the market was looking for. But if you delve down into the revenue line and have a look at where they beat versus where perhaps they lagged expectations a little bit, I think the beat was more on the non-gaming side of the business, the fintech business, the advertising business. And those parts of the business do come through with lower margins than the gaming side. And as a consequence of that, whilst they beat on the top line, it does look to me as though on the operating profit line and on the net earnings line, it was a couple of percent shy of expectations. And if I look at the way the U.S. depository receipts is trading this evening, it looks as though the market is also taking it slightly negatively, Bruce.
Why should I be worried? If I look at my pension fund and I look at how much my pension fund has got invested in Naspers and in Prosus, and I look at how much Naspers and Prosus have got invested in Tencent, and how they're not one trick ponies by any stretch of the imagination, but it's a very big pony in their paddock. Should I be worried about the fact that the Chinese authorities are starting to sort of muscle in on that country's big technology firms, these companies that have exceeded all expectations and have done so brilliantly that Chinese authorities are wanting to exercise some control? Should it worry me?
I'm going to ignore the play on words on pony and move straight on from that, Bruce.
Oh, very good. For those who don't know, I missed my own genius there. The founder of Tencent, of course, is Pony Ma. I didn't even click it. Well done. Thank you, Chris Stewart.
Thank you, Bruce. It's where we were teed up to do these things. Now, should you be worried? No, I don't think you should necessarily be worried. Tencent is a good business. It's a business that is priced for growth, for sure, and it's a business that has continued to deliver that growth and stands a good chance of continuing to compound that growth. The valuation is, you know, one won't argue on a price earnings basis that Tencent is necessarily cheap. You could well argue that on a price earnings basis, Tencent looks actually quite expensive. It is growing. It does continue to grow. There are some regulatory concerns that have caused the share to sell off 20-odd percent over the last 6 weeks or so. And some of those regulatory concerns revolve around Chinese regulators being uncomfortable with the amount of customer data that these tech companies build on their platform and the extent to which they may be using that customer data in an anti-competitive manner in order to limit access to their platform to certain providers and not to others. And equally well, these businesses are increasingly blurring the lines between technology and financial services, if you like. They're starting fintech-type businesses, lending platforms, savings platforms, investment businesses, and they're doing it all outside of the auspices of financial regulation, which means you could argue that they have an unfair competitive advantage relative to regulated financial services companies that have to hold certain amounts of capital in accordance with regulation. So there's no doubt that the road is going to be much trickier for them to navigate into the future. But we draw some comfort from the fact that Tencent is a good business. It has continued to grow. And if you look at, whether you look at Naspers or Prosus, as you indicate, there are other elements to those businesses. And in addition to that, there is a very, very significant discount already put in place on the underlying valuation of Tencent if you look at Naspers or Prosus, for example.
Okay.
And therefore, if you like, the see-through valuation becomes slightly less concerning than, you know, just looking at Tencent on a price earnings multiple.
Got you. Thank you. And then finally, I mean, if we look at government's admission today that it has missed its first deadline on vaccines, we look at the mounting fears of a third wave coming sooner rather than later. We've got government really you know, concerned about super spreader events, and we see that the Ministerial Advisory Committee is recommending to government that we go on a higher level of lockdown over the Easter weekend as a temporary measure to try and limit the risk of super spreader events. I mean, this, the sooner we get vaccinations into people's arms, I see lots of reports of vaccinations coming to land at our airports, but we need to get these blooming things into people's arms and do it quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's almost an inevitability that we're going to have some form of third wave, and I think it's almost an inevitability that we're going to have some form of further restriction. I would hope, and I do believe that policymakers had a look at what happened during the level five lockdown last year and have realized that from an economic and social perspective, it is not something that can be not something that can be implemented to the same degree again. That said, I think we'll get something, and that something will probably in the short term be negatively received by markets. We did, in fact, navigate the most recent lockdown from an economic perspective. It was navigated reasonably well. But anything, I guess, that takes off our fairly modest GDP growth for the year ahead is a negative. So we do need to get the vaccines out. But Bruce, I'm going to be enormously surprised if we've got any sort of real relief from vaccines in the near future. It just doesn't appear to be happening.
No, it doesn't, unfortunately. Chris Stewart, thank you. He is a portfolio manager with 91. The
Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the 2021 winners of Global Finance Magazine's Best Mergers and Acquisitions Bank in Africa and Best Investment Bank in Mauritius. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
Good evening. Welcome to The Money Show. The Money Show on a Wednesday night. Still getting confused with the days of the week because it's been sort of messed up, I suppose, in terms of the regular rhythm of things. Colin Cullis after Eyewitness News at 7 o'clock on why we keep falling for the same scams. Over and over and over again, we still keep falling for scams. And is it because we are gullible? Is it because we're taken horrible advantage of? I would like your views on that this evening as we talk to Colin Cullis, all about business unusual. Also tonight, we're going to be looking at the huge development of blueberries in South Africa. The blueberry market is absolutely enormous. And we're also going to talk to Giancarlo Bjerkes, who is the founder of Impulse Biomedical. Future Growth, the development equity funded Future Growth, has placed a big bet on biomedical. It's a startup business. Giancarlo Bjerkes is the founder of Impulse Biomedical. Are you guys doing coronavirus vaccines that you suddenly so terribly popular, Giancarlo? But I'm not sure that you're necessarily in that market.
Good evening, Bruce. I'd, of course, like to say thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you. So my company essentially did a little bit of work in the COVID or coronavirus space. What we essentially did was we worked with Red Cross Children's Hospital and the Allergy Foundation of South Africa to develop asthma spaces for COVID patients. So essentially what we found is that nebulizer treatment wasn't working as effectively as everyone had hoped. So what we did is we developed low-cost spacers and we distributed that with Polyoak and the Allergy Foundation to we distributed 100,000 of these spaces across the country to try and assist and try and do our part when it comes to COVID-19. So, we definitely did try and assist where we could during this pandemic.
What is the implication of Future Growth's investment? What does it do for you, Giancarlo?
It really is a great opportunity for us in terms of taking our business forward. It's always fantastic when you get an organization such as Future Growth to invest in your business, invest in your vision and your goal and your dream. And with the capital, we are going to be pushing the business forward, taking our Easy Squeezy product to market. We're aiming to get that done by end of this year, and pushing the adrenaline auto-injector, our ZBPen, through clinical trials as well. So we're super excited. It's a great opportunity, and we are really appreciative of Amrish, Melissa, and the team for believing in us.
Biomedical companies, they're not that many, are there, in South Africa? It's a fairly unique sort of business. We're not that big on sort of scientific startups. I wish we were, but it seems like you guys are in an unusual space for South African startups.
We definitely are. There are a handful, and it's always great when we have sort of events and sort of pitch evenings, etc., because we pretty much know most of the companies in the ecosystem. But my business partner Gokul and I, we, for example, did a TEDx talk where we really tried to, you know, put out the message that people should start looking into starting healthcare and medical devices businesses, because there's huge opportunities and we can really make an impact in the medical devices space. Really, our ethos is, you know, we're trying to make healthcare technologies accessible through affordability, making sure that everyone can afford necessary healthcare. It is a small sort of group of people, but we are pushing and trying to spread the message of growing the industry.
Why is it so hard for biomedical companies to get going in South Africa?
It's difficult because of the amount of investment that's required. For example, in our ZBPen adrenaline auto injector, the challenge that we have is that we need to go through clinical trials, which requires quite a bit of capital, so it's quite high risk. But again, it's really high reward because we build the business with a vision of taking the technology further. So it's, you know, it's for South Africa now, but essentially spreading to the rest of Africa and the rest of the world. So it becomes a high impact business, you know, as you sort of move along. But to get over that first hurdle, especially clinical trials, regulatory approvals, it takes quite a bit of investment, quite a bit of time. And we're also sort of fortunate. Our team are working very hard, and we've just been registered as a medical devices manufacturing it by SAHPRA as well. So it's difficult, but it can be done, is essentially what I'm trying to get across.
And I mean, when you look at the growth prospects, the growth opportunities in not quite a vacuum, but certainly in an environment that's not particularly hotly contested, it does suggest that you're onto something good.
We definitely believe so. We're taking on quite a sort of giant, but again, you know, we believe that we can make that impact, and then with partners such as Future Growth and others, we definitely believe that we can do it.
Yeah. How much money are they pouring into you?
At this stage, unfortunately, Bruce, it's confidential.
Is it enough to? Oh, I asked the awkward question, and then I get put on hold. I'm sure he'll be back because he's a nice guy.
Your call has been placed on hold.
No.
Please wait.
Okay, then. I think we've been put on hold. There's the answer to the question. We're not telling you.
Your call has been placed on hold.
Go away.
Please wait.
That's me. Okay, Giancarlo. Is he asking for permission? No, he's not. Anyway,
Your call has been placed on hold.
Yes, okay. I can't get rid of him. Thank you, Giancarlo Biakas, putting me on hold. A founder of a fabulous biotechnology company. And there are not many of these things in South Africa. Giancarlo Biakas, the founder of Impulse Biomedical, the Future Growth Development Equity Fund, putting a bet on this biomedical startup. And we need more startups. We need more scientific startups. We need clever people with clever ideas to be getting their startups off the ground. And this is a fabulous one in the world of biotechnology. On the next Money Show, we've got a panel of experts for the one-year anniversary of the COVID-19 lockdown and its enormous economic effects across the country. On the special broadcast, they will be discussing the pandemic and the lessons that we've learned from it and how we don't go back to the mess that we got ourselves into in the early stages of this crisis. Personal finance expert Warren Ingram on how to make sure that you diversify, and Pavlo Fatini's big ideas, big advice for small business owners. All that next time on The Money Show.
702.
Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
So where are blueberries grown? We'll find out about that in just a moment. I saw an interesting announcement today, and I don't usually click on a change of auditor announcements on Stock Exchange News Service. Invariably, it's just the rotation of one big audit firm to the next. And occasionally, you'll see a smaller audit firm sort of put up its hand and get a big corporate client. But it was interesting today to see that Woolworths has rotated from its existing auditors of EY and going to KPMG. We spoke to Ignatius Suhola, the chief executive of KPMG, who has been instrumental in turning around the operations of that business, of that partnership, also getting a refreshed brand image after it being implicated, of course, in state capture. We're seeing lots of the sort of further revelations coming out about its time at SARS and other issues to do with VBS and others, where auditors allegedly went rogue. Interesting to see the sort of rebuilding and the repositioning of KPMG with the mighty Woolworths.
702.
Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
Do you like to catch George unawares? Blueberries, they've long been regarded as a superfood, but you might not think of them as superheroes of fruit exports. But there has been an explosion. There's been a massive growth rate in blueberries in South Africa. We already know citrus in the Eastern Cape goes all over the world. Lots of Avo farmers in Mpumalanga do a lucrative trade with European export contracts. And despite the lockdown last year, Blueberry exports rose more than 27%. Domestically, they're far more available than they used to be. So, and there's also lots of the frozen fruit around for much of the time. Justin Mudge is the chairperson at berries.co.za. What is driving the blueberry revolution, if you like, Justin?
Thanks, Bruce, for the opportunity to share the good news. I think, you know, we've seen continued investment throughout the sector, and this is, you know, adoption from improved plant material, steady improvements in yields. It's an ongoing story.
Where do blueberries grow? I mean, we kind of expect avos to be growing around in Mpumalanga. We expect citrus fruit to be growing in the Sundays River. We expect maize to grow in the maize quadrangle. Where do blueberries grow?
Berries traditionally been grown in the Western Cape. Somewhere just below 60% of berries are produced in the Western Cape. We're seeing that volume hold steady going forwards, but growth predominantly in Limpopo, and I believe there's untapped potential in the Eastern Cape and Northern KwaZulu-Natal.
Okay, I mean, that's, and again, agricultural products are wonderful. They're job-creating. I just look at blueberry bushes. I've got a couple of images of blueberry bushes open in front of me. They look very fiddly. They look more fiddly than grapes, for example, and grapes can be very fiddly. It's quite a labour-intensive occupation, or is a lot of what is being done within the blueberry space automated?
Bruce, no, it remains a very labour-intensive process, particularly harvesting. Every single berry is hand-picked by colour, so a cluster of berries doesn't ripen uniformly. It ripens individually, so every berry hand-picked, and somewhere close to 10 job opportunities per hectare.
10 jobs per hectare, which is nice. How many hectares under cultivation in blueberries at the moment?
We're somewhere north of 3,000 hectares. And, yeah, we would like to see that grow in the future. And the question that I know that's going to be asked is, where are we going to? Well, I think the answer lies in how big is the opportunity and what opportunity will be created for South African producers to exploit that. I mean, I will back them to exploit that opportunity to the max.
I mean, it's already up 8 or 9 times since 2015. There were just over 1,000 tons in 2015. You now got 15,000 tons last year. That's a 27% increase year on year. So clearly, this is a rapid growth market, which is very exciting. Are they quite dominant in terms of export? I mean, in terms of our fruit exports, is it like, what, 2%, 4%, 5% of all fruit exports? Have you done that sum?
It's relatively small by tons, but if you look at the value, I think it's significant and the opportunity to become more significant. Just in rough numbers, 10,000 hectares, 100,000 tons, 10 billion rands worth of foreign currency. So I think there's a massive opportunity to be exploited.
How long does it take for a blueberry bush to come to fruition? Literally,
John. It's very quick. We can get blueberry plants into production in under 9 months.
Okay, so I mean, it's a lot quicker than planting an orange tree or a lemon tree or a nut tree or an avo tree. You get very quick turnaround on the capital invested, which is nice to see. And you can get up to 10 tons a hectare. I mean, those are the sort of yields that you're getting with what you call the improved stock that you're seeing in terms of the rootstock and the plants that you've got access to.
I think 10 tons is very modest. I think we can do a lot better than that with the improved genetics that South African producers have available to them.
Justin Mudge, lovely story of blueberries blowing the roof off. Thank you, Justin. From Feyerboom. from Fig Tree in the Western Cape, chairperson of Berries South Africa, the huge boom that we're seeing in blueberry production, a rapid growing industry. If you're in that trade, I would love to hear from you this evening. Tell us a tale of how you got involved, why you got involved, and do you continue to anticipate that there is going to be this perpetual blueberry boom?
It's not going to turn out good. Four huge men of the Hawks, and they were not letting me out.
Symington says Moyanu withheld information from the Hawks and the NPA when he laid the charges. Ntakwana Ngadani, Eyewitness News.
The JMPD is urging motorists to remain vigilant and cautious to avoid any road carnage as Joburg residents brace for persistent rainfall. The South African Weather Service has issued a yellow level 2 warning for possible disruptive rainfall. It says although some showers have been experienced in several parts of Gauteng, the most significant rainfall is expected this evening into tomorrow morning. The heavy rains are expected to lead to localized flooding of several roads, low-lying bridges and informal settlements. The JMPD spokesperson, Kolani Fihla.
Motorists are advised to be extra cautious, reduce your vehicle speed, keep a safe following distance, avoid low-lying bridges and flooded roads because you may never know how deep the water is.
And Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa has finally received his COVID-19 vaccine jab in the resort city of Victoria Falls. The city is where health authorities say they want to vaccinate most of its 33,000 residents to boost tourism, which has suffered a major downturn since the country's first case of coronavirus was recorded there last year. This is also part of a consignment that arrived in the country from China last week. Today marks the start of the second phase of the vaccine rollout that began last month in the country. And it's hoped that this high-profile event will encourage others to receive the jab. Gold is trading at $1,735.98 an ounce. The rand's at 14.85 to the dollar, 20.38 to the pound, 17.57 to the euro. Brent crude oil is at $64.52 a barrel. A cloudy Thursday in store for Gauteng tomorrow with scattered showers and thundershowers. Both Johannesburg and Vereeniging dropping to an overnight low of 14, peaking at 18 degrees. Pretoria 15 and 20, clear skies in Cape Town with a gentle northwesterly breeze, a low of 20 and a high of 28 degrees. The top story in Eyewitness News this hour. The Zulu royal family has confirmed that Queen Mamfombi Ladlamini will act as regent of the Zulu nation until King Goodwill Zwelithini's successor has been appointed.
Eyewitness News. In touch, in tune, and independent. For the latest, download the EWN app. The Money Show.
With Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
The Money Show, proudly brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, winners of the Global Finance Magazine Best Mergers and Acquisitions Bank in Africa, the Best Investment Bank in Mauritius. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP. It was a topsy-turvy day on markets. We saw markets massively volatile. We ended the day just slightly down after quite a tumultuous session. The currency fairly steady. We are looking ahead to tomorrow's Reserve Bank decision on the Monetary Policy Committee on interest rates. I can't imagine that they're going to do anything either up or down. There may be some dissent, some members of the MPC looking for a cut in interest rates because inflation is below 3%. And that number came out today, 2.9%. And so there'll be one or two people who will vote for a rate cut. But I suspect that the centre will hold and that rates will remain steady. But we'll know more about that at about 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. But yeah, not a bad day for the JSE relative to the volatility that we've seen around the globe. Chris Stewart at 91 was saying that nice growth numbers coming out for Tencent in China on the revenue line, but the profits were a little on the light side. We did see a bit of a pullback today in the likes of Prosus and Naspers.
The Money Show.
Business Unusual.
With Colin Cullis.
Business Unusual brought to you by OVEX. OVEX, the best place to buy and sell cryptocurrency. Colin Cullis with Business Unusual. Why is it that we fall time and time again for the same old scams?
The short answer, Bruce, is that we do believe when things are too good to be true that they must be true and we go and invest in them. And of course, that's just not the case. But the longer version, and in tonight's particular, is the story of yet another unicorn who has lost its horn or turned out to be a donkey in the first place. And in this particular case, it's the story of Greensill Capital. The super abridged version, to be fair, because it is very complicated and convoluted. Suffice to say that unicorns, these are the startup companies that are valued at over $1 billion and things that venture capitalists and the markets just can't wait to get hold of, whether by IPOs or SPACs, or as in this case, it's recently filed for insolvency protection. So despite being at one point valued at over $10 billion, is now worth a lot less than that. I don't know if you've come across Mr. Lex Greensill before, because here is a CEO with an impressive backstory, super confidence, and ultimately a business plan that maybe wouldn't quite stand up to proper scrutiny if people gave him half the chance. Is it somebody you've come across before?
The name rings a bell, but I couldn't tell you why.
So here's his story. He's an Australian guy who, as a young man growing up on his parents' farm, really was unhappy that the people that would buy from his parents would take a long time to pay for the produce and leave them in a position where they had to struggle just to, you know, look after the next year's crop. He says that forced him to have to do his law degree by correspondence because there wasn't enough money for him to go and study. And so when he saw the world needed more fairness for small suppliers to get more equitable payment of their invoices, etc., he saw this as an opportunity for him to do some good. And I doubt very many people would challenge that. It's crazy for me sometimes to think that suppliers have to wait not just 30 days, but 60 days, 90, 120 days to get paid for something that, you know, they have already actually supplied to somebody. So he begins this rather remarkable business using a term called supply chain financing, which some people know better as factoring, or for you and I, where a supplier has got an invoice but not the funds, in which case a bank or some suitable financial institution will say, you give me the invoice, I'll take a little cut of what you would have gotten, but I'll give you the money now, effectively shortening that process. That's the usual way it works, and it requires the suppliers to go to a bank or financial institution and sort that out. The new version, not that it is that new, called supply chain financing, reverses it. It has the person who is going to be buying the products, who is mindful that potentially their supplier may not have enough funds to complete the delivery of the product they want, and so ensure financing to pay for the supplier to make sure they can get their product, to make sure they can sell it and keep the whole chain going. But I'll ask you if when in May 2019, Lex Greensill was being interviewed by Bloomberg and being asked about his highly innovative and disruptive fintech he had started, whether or not you can hear where he dropped the ball from being able to nail why he was so different from anybody else offering these sorts of services. Take a listen.
Lex, you say you're disrupting this industry. Supply chain finance, but anyone who studied accounting has heard of it. It's been around for 100 years or so. So what is it that is ripe for disruption? What is it that's different about the way you do it? Why not go to if you're a company and you need this kind of funding, why not go to a big bank with a maybe bigger balance sheet?
You bet. Well, if that were the case, we wouldn't have grown to be as big as we are. The reality is that we've harnessed technology, our AI-driven delivery of finance, plus the capital markets, to deliver credit to over 8 million customers around the world over the last 8 years. That's unprecedented and has propelled us to the market-leading position we have today.
Bombast and bulldust. Yes.
Yes. When anybody says leveraging the power of AI-driven platform, whenever they use those words together, you just know actually you have no idea what it's doing, and AI is just a catchphrase for you to sound more disruptive than you are anyway. The one thing that, and it is a rabbit hole in trying to brush up to understand how paying suppliers and supply chains work, gosh, I didn't realize how little I knew. There is something to be said that about 20 years, supply chain financing, the thing, was actually patented, where rather than simply somebody looks to agree to give somebody a loan on the basis they've got some future income coming, that this particular person said, imagine if you could see the entire supply chain. And something these days when we are so globally, the supply chains run all over the show, and it's a real myriad as to where you get your stuff from, to know that just one or two of those things gum up and the whole system falls apart, a bit like, you know, a large tanker getting caught in the Suez Canal.
Yeah.
So how would you, you know, how would you be able to avoid those things? Well, if you could work out in a supply chain who all the suppliers and merchants and all the dependencies were, stick them in a big database, check to see invoices coming and payments made and current cash flows and available balances. And then possibly you could train an AI to go and have a look at the entire supply chain. And on the occasions it starts saying, well, you've got a third tier supplier who's currently not able to get a shipment of widgets that it needs to complete the assembly of the sub-widget system you need. Perhaps you should pay them a call and see if they need something to intervene and give them the bridging finance to get this sorted. So there is a case to be made for having something very clever and sophisticated look at all of that. But what I would imagine is that right now, small companies don't keep the kinds of records that allow you to be able to put an AI at them. And even so, how do you go about training an AI? They need models with millions and millions and millions of records to look for patterns to then apply to the actual data and see if they can find correlations or spot what's going on. So the reason why large banks typically focus on large companies and big supply chains is that there is somebody they pay to go and look at all of them. If you try and say, oh, I can do this on the cheap and do it for very small suppliers, the likelihood is you're going to be skipping over a lot of stuff or making a lot of mistakes. And the final bit that Mr. Greensill mentioned there is that he was talking about looking after 8 million suppliers around the world. Well, that turned out to be less accurate when I explained to you how the whole company was put together. So the idea of this kind of financing is that they're very small margins, and so you have to have lots and lots of people invested in it. And so the company itself should run pretty lean. But Greensill had 4 private jets, not something a small startup in a market like this is capable of running. The other element of it that was highly suspicious was that looking at the various customers, a lot of the suppliers rolled up into a single one, GFG Alliance. That was a very large commodities trading company run by another charismatic kind of maverick CEO, Sanjeev Gupta, who is known for taking risks. He's got a big appetite for risks. So having a financing company take on the kind of risk for a company that itself is quite risky should have set off quite a few alarm bells. But at the time, that wasn't necessarily declared, because what Greensill was declaring as clients were all those little suppliers down the line, not realizing that all of them actually fed up to this main a merchant, GFG, and that effectively if he didn't pay, then everybody else down the line wouldn't get paid. And the thing that was being sold as the asset or held as the asset was the fact that GFG Alliance would pay. And here's where it gets sort of subprime as well, because after Greensill had created these bundle of owed invoices, they took that to an investment company and said, this is a great asset for somebody to want to buy. We're pretty much guaranteed that these loans are going to be paid back because there's invoices against them. So this should be a good return for somebody looking for a low risk, safe bet. And for those who want a little more, we've actually also got insurance so that should one or two of them happen to fail or default on those, the insurance will pay it out. Sounds like a great deal. And if it was actually a good asset, then people would be justified in wanting to buy it. And quite a few were, including the SoftBank Vision Fund, the crazy whale when it comes to investing, whale when it comes to just about any sector of the financial industry at the moment, and headed by Masayoshi Son himself, you know, thrives on risk and gamble. And we last referenced him when we spoke about how WeWork wouldn't. So he gets involved in Greensill and invests $600 million into the company itself, and then may have taken as much as $1.5 billion in assets via Credit Suisse in this fund that was set up. What we didn't know at the time, and thanks to the investigative journalists who can, you know, dig into all of this stuff, is that Greensill then wind up giving financing loans to companies that were also part of SoftFund's Vision Fund. So effectively, SoftFund was taking money it had, gave it to another company that it got ownership for, only to have that money given back to companies that it owned. Something that, under normal circumstances, you'd say that's not a very good way for assets to be moved around, and certainly a terrible way for them to be reported on, when everybody assumes, wow, this is new deals and great deals being shared for everybody. Well, no surprise that at some point,
No, carry on.
No surprise that at some point, somebody does ask a question about the most speculative of all of them. The notion that says, I'm going to be supplying financing to a company in order for it to have funds for some future contract it may get. And in this case, it was a mining company on the belief that a mining company, it was a coal mine, so already right, coal mines, they're doing well at the moment, would get big contracts for coal at some future date. So here's some financing, which we will give you from our pool of finance, and then we will take the, you know, the issued ticket that says, yeah, good, we owe you that money, and stick it back in that pool as if it was, you know, money that was going to come back because they got a contract to conclude, rather than actually what it was. It's simply an unsecured loan. You know, that is crazy. So when the insurers find out that some of the debt that they are securing is for this unsecured type, they say, hang on, we're not that interested. We'd like to unwind our position. Greensill says, no, let us explain. And they say, no, we're out. When they say we're out, the investors who thought everything was hunky-dory start taking a closer look and also start thinking, maybe a bit too rich for my blood, and start withdrawing from the fund. To the point where Credit Suisse itself says, I don't think we can continue with this fund because there's too many questions we've got here and we're going to want to return everybody's money. Now, the challenge there was the big group, the Sanjeev Gupta's group, was mindful that if he can't get money coming from Greensill, he's not going to be able to pay his suppliers. And so rather than being caught out not being able to pay suppliers, he would then stop giving or stop honoring the sort of stuff for Greensill. So Greensill couldn't have him not pay because that's what their value was based on, and he couldn't pay. And so when that eventually happened, you saw Sanjeev Gupta's group is now in lots of trouble, having to try and stave off which parts of their company they can sell, get rid of, whatever else. Greensill is in insolvency, listed itself for insolvent protection, seeing how it can defray various costs and get itself back up and running, which seems unlikely, even though Lex Greensill, about 2 years ago, was very clever in removing a good bit of chunk of the value out of the company for him and his family. So seems to have separated that from himself. And it brings us to where we are now in March 2021, with good many billion dollars worth of money lost. For those in the UK, and another part, because there's elements of David Cameron, the former prime minister, actually looking to try and get the British government to bail them out. The scandal that's involved there, it's just way beyond certainly the scope for this, but it really goes so far down. And that's what got me to, this thing was a scam from day one. And maybe I'm being unfair to call it a scam because, you know, sometimes when I look at high finance deals, they all look the same to me. It's just that I don't get them. They appear as if magic or scams. But there certainly was all of the warning signs. And I think the final thing that I suppose we can say about this is that as long as we're willing to let our guard down, particularly when times are good, then we can expect to see situations develop that will turn them bad. And that was the case here. We simply didn't want to believe that anything go wrong with a fintech startup, good guy, great story, looking to make things better. And we didn't bother checking until it was too late.
Phil Steinhoffy, thank you very much. Colin Cullis with Business Unusual. Do you ever think about investing your money? There's always been risk. Until now, it's called arbitrage, and this is how it works. Bitcoin and cryptocurrency trade at a premium in South Africa. Simply buy overseas and sell them here for profit. It couldn't be easier to invest using the OVEX arbitrage service. Invest as little as 50,000 Rand and trades are done automatically for you. Thousands of investors have been earning over 4% per week. Find out more at ovex.io. OVEX, the best place to buy and sell cryptocurrency.
The Money Show.
Consumer Ninja.
Our Consumer Ninja, Wendy Nola, this evening, as always, on a Wednesday night. It's the, happy birthday to the Consumer Protection Act. I feel protected.
Yes.
You feel protected. Everybody should feel protected. Has it done what it was set out to do, Wendy?
Hello, Bruce. Yes, it's the 10th birthday of the CPA coming up in 2 weeks, the 1st of April. So I'm looking at some of the main protections that were intended and with how that's working out in practice. So the one I wanted to discuss tonight is this thing about the fixed-term contract. So your cell phone contract and your gym contract mainly. Those are the main two that affect people. And originally the legislators, the people, the legal brains that drew up the act, they initially proposed in the bill that there was going to be no sneaky carrying over of contracts anymore, and that your contract ended over and done, obligation finished on the day that the period ended. So a two-year contract, end of that two-year contract, both debit orders must stop, end of. And the cell phone industry pushed back and said, oh, but that's not going to help the consumer. Now, what if they're in an emergency situation, they need to make a call, and suddenly no service, they've forgotten that was the end of the contract, that was the date. No, that's not going to help the consumer. So a compromise came up, and the compromise made its way into the Act, and that is that the contract will carry on a month-to-month basis unless the consumer actively cancels in writing with a month's notice, right? So if your contract ends at the end of this month, end of March, Bruce, you would have had to give notice at the end of February if you didn't want the debit order to carry on for at least a month, right? But most people don't get this. They forget, they don't get it. They think the contract's ended, it's ended. 10 years into the CPA. The compromise was that the cell phone companies have to, and the GM companies, between 40 and 80 days before the end of that so-called initial period, that expiry of that period, they must send you a notification in writing or some other recordable form, as the Act puts it, and tell you what your options are. Basically, it says that they must tell you any material changes that will apply if the agreement is to renewed and carries on beyond the expiry date, and the options available to the consumer, I'm reading from the Act, in terms of renewing or cancelling, and the fact that the contract will automatically continue on a month-to-month basis, subject to any material changes, unless the consumer expressly directs the supplier to terminate the agreement on the expiry date. Okay, so I thought, and I've looked at many of these notices. What's actually happened, Bruce, is that this CPA required notification 40 to 80 days before the end of the period have become dressed up as marketing messages about upgrades.
You get the phone call. You get a phone call and it says, would you like to upgrade? We're going to give you cheaper data. We're going to give you 78 more minutes because we know you haven't been using your minutes because you do WhatsApp calls nowadays anyway. So we're going to give you all this extra stuff. Would you like to renew? And if you're not paying attention, it sounds like a jolly good deal. So you say, well, it's cheaper than I've got at the moment. I get more. Awesome. I'll take it. Thank you very much. And it's disingenuous.
I'd strongly discourage anyone from taking out a new contract over the phone. That's a side issue. What they're supposed to say, first of all, that word upgrade is wrong, Bruce. It's so misleading. It's like almost like it automatically must happen because you're going to get something better. It's a whole new contract. That ties you in for another 2 years. A new handset, it's a whole new contract. This word upgrade gets up my nose more than most. It's a complete euphemism. I hate it. But anyway, so I asked two of them, the biggies. I asked MTN and I asked Vodacom to show me what their notifications say, to see if they comply with what the Act actually says. And so it's things like MTN, yellow, you're ready for an upgrade, your contract, call 135 or visit your nearest MTN store. If you don't upgrade this contract, it will change to a month-to-month term on such and such a date. Promo bundles will expire and your contract will change from this a month to that a month. Thank you. Do you notice anything then that talks about you must, if you don't want it to end, you must cancel with a month's notice? Because I didn't, and they're all like that. Vodacom is the same. I got a sample sent to me a short while ago. Your contract term for this number will soon come to an end. Upgrade today to one of our latest deals. Click here to view or go to a Vodacom outlet. If you do not upgrade, your contract will continue on a month-to-month basis and any discounts may fall away. There is nothing. The CPA says they've got to talk about cancellation, and they don't. And I have a problem with that.
Absolutely. I mean, when you take out the contract, and I've fallen for this as well, because you get busy and it's a mission to go to the shop. So you don't change your contract and you simply roll over your contract. And what you've forgotten in that time is that the reason you entered into the contract was to pay for a phone over 24 months or whatever it was, to 36 months now, yes, that phones are
sometimes
more expensive.
36.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so you pay for this phone over 2 years, and then you get to the end of that two-year period, and then they start running your contract on a month-by-month basis. And the longer you leave it, you're now paying, you keep paying for the phone.
More.
You keep paying over the odds for the phone. You should be downgrading at that point.
Exactly. But the main thing that I see is that people assume that their phone and gym contracts will expire, and that they're not getting – that you actually have to physically cancel them, or they don't, because it seems logical, and it's what the legislators originally wanted, mind you, that when it's up, it's up. Your obligation finishes, and it isn't that. So a colleague of ours, if you've got 1 minute's time, she got one of these, time for an upgrade. And so she said, actually, she wrote back and she said, I want to tell you, I'm giving notice that I do not intend to renew or upgrade this contract. I want to terminate my relationship with you on the final day of the contract. And I want to keep this number to port to another network. And the response was, thank you for getting in touch with the retention team, blah, blah, blah. Our online team will deal with you, whatever. And then while you wait, take a look at these amazing deals. It happened to be Black Friday. Huge banner advert, and right underneath a very huge one, which you could very easily miss because you think, oh, advert, is, please note that you cannot cancel via email. And if you wish to cancel your current contract, please call our call center. If you don't do that, and she's thinking that that email notification suffices, but actually it's so sneaky, Bruce. I can't handle it. So the message is, unless you cancel with a month's notice that you are going to carry, it's going to go to a month to month and you're going to pay for longer than you want to. So you can't trust the notification notices. And, you know, I mean, it's 10 years on. What are the chances that the industry is just going to carry on doing it their way? I'd say pretty good.
I think you may be right on that point, Wendy Nola. And you've got to check out, I mean, you know, all of these adverts say T's and C's apply. And the reason they say that is because there are T's and there are C's, and they cannot, then they're very seldom going to be skewed in your favor. So you've got to have your wits about you.
Please. Yes.
Have your wits about you. Thank you, Wendy Nola, as always, on a Wednesday night. Wendy Nola, our consumer ninja. And yeah, she's infuriated, as many of you are on a regular basis, by cell phone companies. Real concerns there. A story that will not infuriate you, a story that should bring joy to your heart, is coming up next after Eyewitness News. The power of education to fundamentally change the future. If you ever needed more proof than this, I would eat my socks. Luckily, I'm not eating socks. It's 7:30. Wearing socks. I'm not wearing socks. It's too hot to wear socks. I'm not eating. Of course,
it's not that hot.
Hey, Bruce. You know what? If you've ever been in my shoes, Gladys Mutelli, you know just how warm it can get. Anyway, that's enough detail. What's happening in Eyewitness News?
Well, we begin in the Western Cape this evening, Bruce, where President Cyril Ramaphosa has granted Struggle Star Ward Cecil Essau a special provincial funeral. Premier Alan Windey says he wrote to the president yesterday after receiving a request from his family. Essau died from natural causes at his home in Table View last week. In a statement, Windey says he was a son of the Western Cape who was born in Worcester, attended the University of the Western Cape and fought for freedom. The funeral will take place in Worcester on Saturday and will involve an official ceremony conducted by the police service. The national flag will also be flown at half mast across the province on the day. Staying in the Western Cape, the DA has launched a petition to make Afrikaans equal to English at Stellenbosch University. The party says the aim of the petition, which has so far garnered over 3,000 signatures, is to protect the right to mother tongue education. In 2016, the institution implemented a new language policy that elevated the status of English in an effort to avoid making students who were not fluent in Afrikaans feel marginalized and excluded. However, reports have emerged that some first-year students at several residences were allegedly banned from speaking Afrikaans in their rooms or to their peers. The DA's Leon Schreiber has accused the university's management of being anti-Afrikaans, saying the language must be granted equal status for teaching and student life.
In our petition, we demand that the first draft of the new language policy be rejected because it will result in an even further exclusion of Afrikaans students. Instead, a new policy must create a fair language dispensation that grants absolutely equal status to Afrikaans and English as primary languages at the university.
The Treatment Action Campaign is calling on the government to declare tuberculosis as a national health emergency. The organization made the call at the commemoration of World TB Day in Mpumalanga today, where they staged a protest outside the venue demanding that the treatment of TB be taken as seriously as the COVID-19 pandemic. Since the outbreak, diagnosis and treatment of other serious lung diseases have been hampered, with fears that progress in tackling the TB pandemic have been overlooked. The disease has killed 1.4 million people globally, and over 10 million people contracted the disease in 2019. Delivering a keynote address, Deputy President and Chairperson of the South African AIDS Council, David Mabuza, says government will ensure that TB patients are given more priority.
We are calling on all our people to rally behind our national efforts to end TB and scale up our national response. We should also work hard to regain those who have fallen by the wayside. Each and every one of us has a role to play in the fight to end TB.
And Tesla boss Elon Musk says the company's customers can now buy their cars with Bitcoin. Musk, a well-known Bitcoin enthusiast, made the unexpected announcement in a tweet. But Bitcoin's value rapidly moves up and down, meaning that the cryptocurrency price of the car could change day to day. Tesla has invested heavily in the digital currency, buying $1.5 billion worth of Bitcoin. A cloudy Thursday in store for Gauteng tomorrow with scattered showers and thundershowers, lows of between 14 and 15, highs of between 18 and 20 degrees. Clear skies in Cape Town with a gentle northwesterly breeze, a low of 20 and a high of 28 degrees. The top story this hour, President Cyril Ramaphosa has granted struggle stalwart Cecil Essau a special provincial funeral.
Clement Maniatella.
Weekday mornings.
9 to 12.
What do you say to South Africans who are losing hope in this organization? I mean, must they still hope in such a party? Is it even an option when we go to the elections?
How I was trained in the ANC was that the strategic objective is transfer of power to the people. The ANC is merely fortunate to be an instrument in exercising that power on behalf of the people of South Africa. If the ANC can correct its ways, the people of South Africa must look for different alternatives.
Inokotongana.
Clements Maniatella.
9 to 12 on 702.
Courier services just got a whole new makeover. Skynet and Dropper have joined forces. That means you now get Skynet's courier and express parcel services and Dropper's on-demand delivery services all in one. With just one app, you can order on-demand couriers and fleets to pick up and drop off whatever you need, documents, gifts, even shopping, with real-time tracking. With Skynet Dropper, let your thumb do the drop nationwide.
Always making a plan to get the job done? Why circle? Join us at Chamberlain's for our Easter promotion and get incredible deals on all things DIY. From 19 March until 11 April, we're simplifying DIY with amazing offers on a wide range of tools and gardening equipment. Plus, with 10% off all Chamber Value paint mixing, you can decorate more than eggs this Easter. Hop down and experience our famous service, expert advice and amazing DIY deals. Chamberlain's, famous for hardware since 1903.
Okay, seriously? You still don't have fibre at home? Then you need to make a plan. Get Vodacom Fibre today. You know you need seamless internet to stream your best Netflix series or have those online meetings or lessons. Sign up today and receive free installation, activation and router, keeping you connected so you can enjoy more of the things you love. Yes! Available at any Vodacom for You store nationwide or email ebusupport@vodacomforyou.co.za for more info. T's and C's apply.
Get all the time-saving tools you need to grow your small business and see the beauty in numbers with Xero Cloud Accounting Software. This week on 702, Xero is in the spotlight. Find out how Xero can help your business. Run it while you're on the go. Reconcile in seconds and get a clearer picture of how your business is doing in real time. Xero Accounting Software in the spotlight on 702 this week. Go to xero.com and try Xero free for 30 days.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the 2021 winners of Global Finance Magazine's Best Mergers and Acquisitions Bank in Africa and Best Investment Bank in Mauritius. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
This Shapeshifters feature is brought to you by Momentum Corporate. Momentum, here for you on your journey to success.
The Money Show.
Shapeshifters.
Proof tonight, if you ever needed it, of the power of education to truly transform lives. So much of our focus of trying to fix the mistakes of the past is in treating the symptoms. So lots of money goes to those that protest the loudest because they naturally feel hard done by. But we know from countless studies that if we're going to fix the country, if we're going to sort out education, it has to start in pre-primary, go through primary and into high school. And that's where you tee young people up for a considerably better future than just throwing money at the student issue. And as much as students want a tertiary education, it's putting lipstick on the education bulldog. It's not solving the problem. You're not providing the grounding that young people need in order to get the building blocks of great education. Tonight is a story of a not-for-profit school at Ottery in Cape Town. It's called Crystal House. The chair of Crystal House School is Ian Russell. Before we get to the school, who was Crystal, Ian?
Oh, good evening, Bruce. Crystal Dehan was part of a partnership, an entrepreneurial partnership with her husband, who created the original timeshare industry in the late 1970s into the 1980s. And when they retired and sold their business, they wanted to do the right thing with the pile of billions of dollars that they had. And part of that was creating a global foundation that now has 8 schools around the world, of which we are one. And we are hugely grateful to the impact that Crystal has had on so many children.
What is the connection to South Africa? What is Crystal's connection here?
She lived and traded from here for a wee while, and as a good Dutch family, spent quite a lot of time with the Afrikaans background here as well. So she had a big network in South Africa, loved being here, and she sadly passed away about 6 months ago, but she spent a lot of time in South Africa until her health began to fail her.
So what was a big goal? What was the aim of these 8 schools and the one in Ottery?
So the stated vision of the foundation and very much our focus here in Ottery is how do you break the cycle of poverty through the use of education as a key empowerment tool. And like many of us, and as you summed up in your introduction, Bruce, you know, the reality is that without an educated youth, you can't create an economically valuable population. And it's a critical building block of any economy anywhere in the world. And that's exactly what we're trying to do at Crystal House.
So how do you do it? What makes you different? I mean, there are thousands of schools around South Africa in the public and private sectors. They're not-for-profit schools. They're for-profit schools. Lots of people doing lots of different things. But I think the Crystal House model has got something very particular going for it.
The Crystal House model has 2 or 3 things going for it. Number one, we have access and support from a global foundation, which means that we can listen and learn from 7 other institutions around the world in terms of what does and doesn't work. And the way in which these schools were set up was very much in a cookie cutter approach. So we've adopted, you know, very much a best of breed opportunity. We've learned what works in Mexico. We know what works in the Philippines. We know what works in Ottery, and we built around a very strong core curriculum. That's the first thing. The second thing is that we've always been absolutely focused on a self-sustaining ecosystem. So how do you make sure that whilst you need to raise funds to run these schools, as much of the community as possible is involved in the running of that school as well? So we have our own farm, as an example, where we grow the foodstuffs that go into the canteen then feeds the children. And of course, nutrition is such a critical part of enabling anybody to learn. You cannot learn on an empty tummy. But then we make sure that the parents of the children involved in that farm, well, they might be processing the food in the canteen, they might be serving. So it's about how you start to create that sort of self-serving ecosystem around the population. That's critical. Third thing is we've been relentless in ensuring that we manage to attract the right management teams and the right teaching capability into the school. And we have a very, very strong focus at Crystal House Ottery about making sure that the CEO and her team, you know, really are the best of the best. And that impact that we can then make with those 3 building blocks has been quite remarkable.
How do kids get into Crystal House? Because it's not a vast campus. There are tens of thousands of kids, though the queue sounds like it might be quite long. Kids qualify to get in?
So we wish we had tens of thousands. We have just under 1,000 people in Ottery. We take them from the poorest of the families in sort of the neighboring 20 or so areas, our catchment areas, if you like. The key criteria is that the gross monthly income for the household that the child comes from cannot be more than 1,500 rand. And sadly, that is still far, far more people than we can possibly take through. Yeah. So we bring the young children in, we try and take them in at the age of 4, and we try and look after them to the age of 18 until they get to matric. So again, you know, it's very much an end-to-end theme that we take through that. And yes, there are more children than we can take in every year. And we look at the catchment pools that we've got, the most needy children that there are there, and we try and find them a home in the school for their education.
How do you manage families with a couple of kids, with several kids, say 2, 3, 4 kids, and one kid gets in and now you're full and there are 3 kids waiting at the gate? It creates all kinds of problems, doesn't it? If you sort of, if one kid gets a privileged access to an institution that could change their life and the other 3 are left outside, that's a difficult balancing act, I'm sure.
It occasionally happens. It doesn't happen routinely, but it occasionally happens. It's something that you need to manage. And one of the things we're looking at the moment as we say, how can we expand our impact, is how can we bring the families and communities close to the school, tighter to what we're doing, even if their kids are not actually at the school. And it's something that we're working very thoughtfully on at the moment. And what's the outreach program? How do we maybe open the buildings and some of the teaching capacity we've got out of hours at the weekends or in the evenings to some of the children not able to go through there? And we're having some of those conversations right now in terms of how we expand our impact.
It is weird, isn't it? How schools, I mean, we've got a schools crisis in South Africa, but we're incapable as a country to say, right, let's do 2 shifts. Let's do a 7 a.m. to a 2 p.m. and a 2 p.m. to a 7 p.m. or whatever the case is. Well, I mean, you'll do the maths, you're in education. But we split the day somehow in order to double the size of the, you know, double the capacity we have. And not every school is going to be suited to it, and some will be more suited to it than others. And we just don't utilize these facilities, and they stand dormant over weekends, the vast majority of schools. When the gates close on a Friday, they reopen again on a Monday. It's such a waste of facilities, isn't it?
Yeah, if you're in a manufacturing business, then you wouldn't allow your asset to lie idle for 12, 14 hours of the day. So we're looking at that, as I say, very much at the moment. But it's not just, unfortunately, the physical asset. You also need the teaching staff and the capability to come through into that. So we're looking at what might a vocational night school kind of approach be. So use those facilities, let's say, from 6 until 10 in the evening, using some of the same teaching staff, but at least some of the infrastructure that we've got into that community. One of our biggest concerns at the moment, interestingly, is the scaffolding and the support that we do or don't put in place for the children that leave at the age of 18. So if you think about this for a moment, you've kind of got an fortunate child that's had a good few years in the school. They've got a better quality education than many of their peers will have had access to. But if you don't then nurture and take care of that child as they go back out into the wild world, then you may lose some of the opportunity that's been given there. So how do we scaffold and make sure that those children are able to get through into university? I mean, our matric.
I want to talk about results in a moment, because it's really impressive, the track record that you've developed. And then you've got then it's a wonderful problem to have, but it is a problem nevertheless to then transition those kids from school into higher education and perhaps support later on as well. These communities that these kids are coming from are some of the toughest in the country, in some cases, some of the toughest in the world. And you know, just because you come from a poor area doesn't mean that your family is dysfunctional, doesn't mean that your area is dysfunctional, but it, you know, these environments are quite tough. What is the parental participation in supporting the farm, supporting the kitchen, supporting the children? Because so much of education is great in the classroom, but then kids go home to often very difficult environments.
It's a huge issue, and we are so lucky in terms of the communities that we serve and the engagement that we have across that, but it doesn't come without effort and time and energy. We talk within the school of a character-led approach to the education. A lot of that character is formed within your family circumstances, not just in the school, of course. And we find that as we spend more time with the parents and we do our best in terms of outreach programs and so on to help them understand what their child is going through at school, that we do start to develop a bond. And as I say, some of that economic ecosystem that you're creating to self-sustain forms a key part of that as well.
We're talking this evening to the chair of Crystal House SA School, Ian Russell, one of eight around the world, from the proceeds of one of the creators of Timeshare through the 1980s and 90s. Her name was Crystal Dahan. She died fairly recently, but she's left this incredible legacy of schools across the world, the Philippines, Mexico, and of course, Ottery in Cape Town. It is a school which provides superior schooling for kids from the age of 4 to 18 out of poorer communities in Cape Town, access to just 1,000 kids, and tries to do it in a fair and equitable way in very difficult circumstances. But the results that these guys get are nothing short of extraordinary, and the outcomes for these children is what is so absolutely remarkable. We'll pick up on that with Ian Russell, the chair of Crystal House, in just a moment.
Bongani Bingwa, 702 Breakfast.
Weekday mornings, 6 to 9.
Tell us the random thing you know they've been stolen from outside your house.
They are stealing taps and the dustbins.
No, man, taps.
People also steal vegetables. You'll find your garden bare.
The world's gone mad.
You know when you fill up a 2-liter bottle with water and put it outside on the outside lawn so the dogs don't leave the droppings there? Well, empty out your water and take that 2-liter bottle and leave with it. You can stay with your grass.
Bongani Bingwa, 6 to 9
on 702.
The future of accounting and finance has arrived through Sage Intacct. Voted a leading cloud core financial solution by Gartner 4 years running, Sage Intacct unlocks increased visibility, actionable insights, and real-time decision-making to meet the evolving needs of finance leaders across industries. Visit intacct.sage.co.za and experience the future of finance today. That's Sage Intacct with two C's.
Break away to bliss with Dream Hotels and Resorts. 2020 kept us boxed in, but 2021 holds the promise to break free. Local travel is thriving in South Africa. All it needs is you. With 21 destinations across the country, we guarantee memorable holiday experiences for the whole family. Call us or book online at dreamresorts.co.za. Quote Dream 702 and get 25% off. Dream Hotels and Resorts, the freedom of affordable holidays.
Being clear is tough. It's easy to say a lot without saying anything. It's easy to sound smart without actually being smart. At BDO, they believe a better approach to auditing, tax and advisory is about clarity, being honest, deliberate and ethical in how they think, what they say and what they do. Isn't that what your auditor should be? To learn more about their commitment to clarity, visit bdo.co.za.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the 2021 winners of Global Finance Magazine's Best Mergers and Acquisitions Bank in Africa and Best Investment Bank in Mauritius. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Shapeshifters.
Ian Russell is chair of Crystal House SA School, and the outcomes for children who go to Crystal House, these 1,000 kids from the community around Ottery, some of the poorest families in Cape Town. These kids are given an opportunity to go into an environment, a school that has got a global network that is funded by a foundation left by Crystal Dahan, who made her money out of timeshare. How do you teach? Do you do things differently at Crystal House, or is it simply teaching the old-fashioned way, teaching the South African curriculum, Ian, and giving the kids the focus, the time, the energy and the discipline that is needed in order to get decent outcomes?
We absolutely teach the South African curriculum. There's no way around that. Otherwise, your matric results and your fit for function into your own tertiary education system simply won't be there. So it's the application, as I said earlier, of a very holistic approach to the children in the school. It's understanding that they need to be fed properly. We need to have emotional and psychological support on site, and we do, to make sure that those needs are looked after. We understand the need, they must work hard. I mean, they've been given an opportunity here. So instilling that work ethic, helping them understand that they have an opportunity not to be wasted, all comes around that kind of character-led approach to education. And we have a great educational team that works very hard. We lengthen the school day compared to the government schools here deliberately. We want to hold them at school a little bit longer. They are safe at school. They are well fed at school. And we want that access and contact time. So our school day is a little bit longer. But nothing other than that is outside of the ordinary in terms of the South African curriculum and approach.
What do you do with that extra time?
So it's about making sure there's plenty of contact time with teachers. Our class size is a little bit smaller than most government schools would have as well. So it's all about just extending and making more immediate that teaching experience.
Is there any sport? I mean, sport is so valuable in any educational curriculum, but it's very difficult to do. Facilities are scarce. Time is tight. Coaching staff are difficult to come by. But do you include sport in the curriculum?
We used to before COVID-19, but absolutely.
I'm talking about in the real world, not this fast that we're living through right now. It's a horrible time. Yes.
We all look forward to getting better. But it's absolutely, sport is a huge part of any school experience. If you go to the school, you'll see kids everywhere, either throwing cricket balls around or kicking footballs, as you'd expect, and playing netball and so on. Only 2 or 3 years ago, actually, one of our pupils made the South African fencing team. As an example, at representative level, we had a school fencing team that was being able to compete with all the privately funded schools. So, yes, sport is important to us, as is music, drama, dance, and those kind of things. So it is a properly rounded education. We're not just focusing on the matric results here.
But those matric results, though, are considerably above the average. I mean, South Africa, I get so frustrated every year when we announce matric results and the Department of Education stands up and says, oh, we got an improvement. And they discount the kids who started in grade one who never make it through to sitting their matric exams. And there's a huge fallout within the South African educational system for a myriad of reasons. But we don't acknowledge that nearly enough. You guys have a very, very committed focus on the kids who come to you from the age of four.
Absolutely. I mean, if you take the national statistic, it's absolutely horrible. I think of every 100 learners that start school, only 52 take matric. Of that 100, 42 will pass matric, right? So, you know, when you look at the sort of the reported rate of 80% matric pass rate, it's 80% of the 52 that made it there in the first place, which is quite scary. When we look at what we're doing in Crystal House, our dropout rate, and it happens very, very occasionally, we might get the odd child dropping out through the process, but it's incredibly rare. So we're in the high 90% in terms of, you know, those that start will finish and will take matric.
Yeah, it's so important. What sort of results are you seeing? I mean, what sort of strengths are you seeing coming out of the kids?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you just say the actual examination results and you take 2020, which obviously was impacted quite significantly by the COVID-19 disruptions and our migration into an online training and learning program, we still got 100% matric pass rates and an 80% bachelor's pass rate. So just think about that for a second. That 80% bachelor's pass rate is really what counts when it starts to be able to launch children's careers into tertiary education and into value-adding roles when they actually get into the working population. That is not shabby. That really is not shabby.
The trouble is, what you've done for these children is you've given them wonderful access to a great education. It's been heavily subsidized for kids from very poor families. These are not kids who've got access to the funding for tertiary education. And as we know, the funding of tertiary education at the moment is very, very difficult. And how then are you able to, do you see it as your responsibility to help these young people then transition towards tertiary? Because clearly you're giving them a head start on many other kids in the South African environment, and you want them to be able to really exercise what they've learned in the 13, 14 years that they spend with you.
Absolutely, Bruce. So our view is that we will try and maintain contact and create a support role for the individual for at least 5 years after they've left Crystal House. That is not a financial support role. It's about career coaching and counselling. It's about support in terms of what they're finding difficult when they get to university and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of outreach support from the school beyond the age of 18 until their early 20s. But as I said earlier, one of the things we're still looking at is how can we get better at that scaffolding, that platform that you put in place for the individuals to succeed, because you can only break this cycle of poverty that we talk about if these individuals start to get into value-adding roles in the economic community, not becoming Uber drivers, quite frankly. You know, it's about how you put them into roles that can really make a difference and start to change the value chain.
Have you been going long enough for this thing to be going full circle, where kids have matriculated and they've come back and they're starting to contribute back into the communities from which they've come?
So we're 20 years old this year, so we're just getting to that point now where there's that almost pay it forward opportunity, and we certainly see some alumni coming back around, but I think we're going to have much more of that kind of virtuous circle ahead of us in the next few years, and it's something we're really looking forward to.
Thank you so much for coming and sharing the story of the amazing Crystal House SA School. Ian Russell, who is chair of the school founded in Ottery in Cape Town. Ian Russell, thank you for sharing that story. Get the results your business wants with a winning employee benefits formula from Momentum Corporate. Working in partnership with you, they will apply their deep insights into the science of employee benefits to formulate your evidence-based solution. The result will be employees who feel appreciated, protected, and invested in the success of your business. Momentum Corporate success is a science.
These days, your weekends might look a little different.
Girl, what?
But we know they've never sounded better.
Weekend Breakfast with Refilwe Mpakanyane.
This is something.
Start your Saturdays and Sundays with a healthy dose of laughter.